This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 8:46 in the morning and you're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9. I'm Julian Ng and together with me are Melissa Idris and Ibrahim Sani. Melissa, you just chatted with our very interesting grill guest. So what do we have to say about ASEAN? Because we're going to cover this story that Axiata is rumored to sell some of their stakes around the region.
Yeah, so when I read this news report that Axiata may be looking at selling off different parts of its businesses around ASEAN, I guess I wondered how many people truly buy into the potential of ASEAN, the fact that ASEAN can work, that as Karim very beautifully put it, the United States of ASEAN, right? We want to see it as an entire region that can work together, free flow of goods, services and labour. But how many businesses and people on the ground and communities feel the same way? Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether this news report about Axiata is a reflection that some people don't see it as a priority.
Well, not to put too much of a fine point to that, we'll cover that in a while. But as far as ASEAN is concerned, I think the ASEAN region as a whole can work because you're talking about an area with a population size of 600 million, right? That's about half of China's size.
I don't doubt the potential.
Exactly. Yeah. I think according to some reports, it's going to be the fourth largest economy in the region, in the world, actually, in 2050. So as a region, it can work. But just that idea of the AEC, that free movement of labor and capital and ideas and so on, I don't know how committed our politicians and our leaders are towards this idea of an integrated AEC.
Yep. I think it has to have the buy-in of the people as well. It's not just coming from top down, right? So it's people like you and me, man, the average Joe on the street, who believe that an AEC will benefit them in the long run.
Okay, going back to Axiata, actually, this is not a confirmed story. It's rumored and it's carried by Bloomberg. And it's not just ASEAN, because we're talking about all the subsidiaries of Axiata being up for sale. And apparently Axiata is looking for some buyers, looking to raise some money for their holdings.
So Bloomberg is talking about Axiata trying to pare down their stake in Dialogue Axiata in Sri Lanka, Spark Axiata in Cambodia, and also their Indonesian unit XL Axiata. And they say that this sale could fetch as much as $700 million based on their overseas holdings. But there is an official statement coming in from Axiata saying that in the event of any transactions that Axiata enters into, Axiata will make all the necessary disclosure at the appropriate time. And until such time, Axiata says that these reports are still speculative.
Okay, so they're not confirming nor denying the truthfulness or the veracity of what Bloomberg reported. But I think that, these are some of the biggest contributors to Axiata. For example, XL is in Indonesia. Dialogue, one of the biggest contributors to Axiata after Celcom, right? You must wonder if this is true, why they're doing it. Are they trying to refocus? Are they trying to raise money for something else?
Or even pare down their debts? Because if you take a look at some of their debt numbers, their net debt to equity ratio has been steadily increasing year on year. In 2011, it's about 22%. In 2013, it's about 33%. Right now, as of last year, it stood at about 46%. So does this mean that they have to look very closely at their net debt equity ratio? Is there a need for them to pare down their debts very significantly?
Also, you're really talking about ownership of some of these markets, the strongest growing markets in around the region. You would really want to focus on that.
Yeah.
And also the question of who would buy. If you're just going to sell little bits of a stake, it must not be a strategic buyer. It must be someone who wants to buy into some of these stakes and very small stakes and looking to exit sometime in the future. It brings up the question of how Axiata wants to exit some of these units and how strategically they want to treat some of these units.
So if this story is in fact true, I mean, look at these markets, right? Cambodia and Sri Lanka. You would think that they hold so much potential for a telco like Axiata. I'm just wondering, are there other markets that perhaps are kind of higher on the priority list, if in fact the story is true? Or do they think that maybe that focus and that energy is better redirected back home?
Well, if you look at what they own right now, they have a presence in, a very big presence in Indonesia, in Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Cambodia, and on a more associate level, India, Singapore, Pakistan. They're also going into the towers business with 100% ownership of E.co. So there are certain countries that are missing from the ASEAN jigsaw. For example, Vietnam is not really there. Mm-hmm. The Philippines, not really there. So those could be some of the countries that they can go into. But certainly in Sri Lanka, Cambodia, Bangladesh, you're talking about huge ownership. You're talking about 80 to 90%, almost 100% of stakes in these companies. So they may still be able to exert some degree of control even if they sold off some stakes there.
There's also a lot of synergy with these E.co business because if you're a telco, much of the business is reliant on your own capacity. But with E.co and the telco tower services, they can easily find competitors to work with them because
once they rent out the towers. Yeah.
And it's not a competition at all because once you have the infrastructure, you're looking for joint rental services, not just for your own telco, but other telcos as well.
852 and the 12 to 18% interest rate for homes by developers still making the headlines with Tan Sri Noor Omar, the Urban Wellbeing, Housing and Local Government Minister, saying that this is going to go up to the cabinet level for discussion.
So who has said what, right, with this proposal? It started off with Tan Sri Noor Omar, the Minister for Urban Wellbeing and Housing Minister, saying that developers can now act as moneylenders as accorded by the law Moneylenders Act 1951. But Zahid Hamidi, the Dato' Sri Zahid Hamidi, the Deputy Prime Minister, has said that the cabinet has been left in the dark over this proposal. So when they meet today, the cabinet meeting meets every morning, every Wednesday morning, he has asked Tan Sri Noor Omar to actually explain what this proposal means. On top of this, right, Dato' Johari Ghani, the finance minister, second finance minister, has argued that this proposal is outright not logical, basically saying that if a person can't afford to pay the 4% bank loan, how can this person pay the 18% bank loan interest rate?
I liked how you referred to Zahid Hamidi as the Zahid Hamidi. Like he's an entity, institution by himself. Okay, so what I understand from what you just said is that the cabinet doesn't know anything that Tan Sri Noor Omar has announced about this proposal. And the finance ministry doesn't seem to know what he's talking about either. So my takeaway from that is that, you know, this was an announcement made without consultation of the people in government.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I also think it's really opening up a can of worms. For example, the HBA, which is the House Buyers Association, came out to ask whether Bank Negara knows about this and whether they have approved this. And also the Penang government has banned this kind of Along type loans.
Ayo is in the Cambridge,
Oxford
Dictionary. Yes.
You're allowed to use it.
I'm allowed to use that now.
Oxford
has allowed
you. Don't
me
have
to
use any atas words,
which is also in there.
Yeah. Okay, so does that not strike you as incredibly upside down, right? Topsy turvy. Make the announcement first. The whole country's in chaos. The business community's scratching their heads, and then you present it to cabinet.
Okay. I think something good is coming out of this.
What silver lining do you see?
Because everyone is so up in arms about this that this probably would not see the light of day. And people have been so forewarned already that they probably would not take up such an expensive loan like this.
Well, the talk around it, right, has increased awareness.
Raising awareness.
I get the feel, right, as well, Melissa, because you're saying that where is it? How does the policy take place?
What's the process?
There's a process. There is a process, by the way. First, you need to have a ministerial approval. Then you get the cabinet approval. Then you get the executive approval. That's why Tan Sri Noor Omar says that this is not a new scheme. He has said that some housing developers already hold the Moneylenders Act license. And he says that this might be revoked if the cabinet decides to do so.
Okay, still on the subject of interest rates and returns, the Singapore government is asking to review the CPF's investment scheme. This is none other than the Deputy Prime Minister, Mr. Tharman. He's saying that some people have made a lot of losses from these schemes.
Yeah, so the Singapore Deputy Prime Minister says that over the past 10 years, more than 80% of CPF members who put their savings into investment product via the CPFIS or investment scheme would have been better off leaving their money in an ordinary ordinary account, which guarantees them a 2.5% each year. So he says that some investment products give better returns than their CPF. And he questions whether or not this should be the way. And that's why EPF or CPF in this matter needs to be undergoing some sort of reform in order for them to give the best returns for their savers.
I personally think that the Singapore government, if they restricted this, would be going into wrong direction, because I think the problem is not the losses, although those are a very big problem. I think the problem is really the lack of advice. People just think that the stock market is a way to make free money and not realizing the kind of risks that are involved. Just like people, if not being advised properly, go into take up those 12 to 18% loans, right? Those will be people who are ill-advised and then land up in very, very big problems. Now, comparing the CPF to the EPF, for instance, I think we'll be quite happy to say that the EPF has given pretty decent returns, over 6% over the last 5 years, whereas the CPF, which is Singapore's version, 2.5% to 4% over the last few years.
Jules, do you see this as kind of embodying the debate that's happening throughout the investment community about passive investing and active investing?
Yes, I think so. And I think people really need to realize the kind of animal that global stock markets are, is not something to be taken lightly. And you really need advice on how to get into those investments. But at the same time, there is that retirement sufficiency problem, right? In Singapore, cost of living, standards of living are so high. In Malaysia, we you know, don't have enough money even in the EPF account. We really need to also raise our return rates by taking extra risk, but on a measured pace. So we need advice.
I think we can take a small ounce of delight in the fact that EPF is kicking CPF's dividend returns in the butt.
Okay, so while I would like to enjoy that statement that you just made, Melissa, my question is how sustainable is our 6% interest rate dividend return, right? Because globally around the world, they can't sustain that kind of number. Maybe we're looking at 2 to 4%. Is this the new normal for our EPF to be returning the level of dividends to us?
Well, it's hard to predict whether it would go down to that range of 2 to 4% or not. And also in Singapore, I think that their income is much higher. They also have a very high home ownership level there, and that adds to the wealth. Also, the Sing dollar is very strong. So we know that in developed markets, the stronger your currency is, the lower the interest rates are going to be, the return rates on your deposits are going to be. Whereas the EPF, being invested, very heavily invested in ringgit, get higher returns from ringgit fixed income and government bonds. But the question is, what can you do with this ringgit, right? That's the big question. You're earning 6.something% right out of this ringgit. What can you do with it is what we're going to ask, apart from the retirement sufficiency problem. Okay, we're going to bring some more market news after the news right now, which is going to be read by Keith Kam, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.